Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about Nicholas Copernicus, a Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, Episode 2. Now, we've learnt a little bit about, a bit more about Nicholas Copernicus in this one, in that he was really neither in Poland or Germany, but in a free city, if there's such a thing. Then we learnt some more aspects that the medieval or the early Renaissance view of medicine involved astrology. So astrology meant astronomy. So astrology and astronomy were pretty much the same sort of science, stuff like that. Then the idea of the planets were different than Ptolemy, but we also learnt that Ptolemy was laughed at by the Arabs, who introduced some more facts, and people began to question Ptolemy. One of the questions of the Ptolemaic system is that the moon should change size from a double in size in its orbit. They've got epicycles and equants, and you tend to talk about epicycles in school and leave everything else. And he wrote a series of small books, one on commentary, one on coinage, sort of a preface to it, and then Revolution Orbits. And this was taken to Germany to be printed on the view that the printing technology in Germany was better. You've got different people coming in. And so we've got 2.3 for Nicholas Copernicus called On the Revolutions. The Commentarius was only intended as an introduction to Copernicus' ideas. He wrote, quote, "Mathematical demonstrations intended for my larger work should be omitted for brevity's sake. In a sense, it was an announcement of a greater work that Copernicus has begun. Commentarius was never published during Copernicus' lifetime, but he sent manuscript copies to various astronomers and philosophers, who received some discouragement because the heliocentric system seemed to disagree with the Bible, but he was mostly encouraged. Although Copernicus' involvement with official attempts to reform the calendar was limited to no longer to a longer extant letter, that endeavour made a new serious astronomical theory welcome. Fear of the reaction of ecclesiastical authorities was probably the least of the reasons why he delayed the publishing of his books." So that's one of the major things, in terms of that they've got a good story and they fit the facts to it. And people say that he was frightened. But the most important reasons for the delay was that the larger work required both astronomical observations and intricate mathematical proofs. His administrative duties certainly interfered with both research and writing. He was unable to make regular observations he needed from Frombrook, which was often fogged in and was not a good place for those observations. Moreover, in Gingerix, as Gingerix in 1993 pointed out, quote, now, this is interesting. So the real reason was not that he feared the church. In fact, the church said it's probably quite good. Was that he was in a foggy part of Europe. Copernicus was far from the major international centres of printing which that could properly handle a book, a large technical as De Revolutionibus. And this is one of the things I said earlier on, that the printing revolution occurred in major things. It's sort of like you want to make a movie, you really want to go to Bollywood or Hollywood. Elsewhere it's a lot more difficult. On the other hand, his manuscript was still full of numerical inconsistencies, and he knew very well that he had not taken complete advantage of the opportunities that the heliocentric viewpoint offered. Furthermore, Copernicus was far from academic centres, thereby lacking the stimulation technically trained colleagues with whom he could discuss his work. So he was really in a backwater. So if you wanted to say for a position in Australia, it's sort of like being in Hobart to talk about tropical fish. The manuscript on the revolutions was basically complete when Nicholas came to visit him in 1539. The work comprised of six books. The first book, the best known, discussed what came to be known as Copernican theory, and what Copernicus' most important contribution to astronomy, the heliocentric universe. Well, that's so six books, there you go. Like Copernicus' model, the Sun is not truly at the centre. Well, there it goes. What the heck does that mean? What does it mean that Copernicus' model? Book one set out, well, there's a piece of information that he's a heliocentric thing, and that the Sun is not truly at the centre. Book one set out the heavenly body is about the Sun. The sphere of fixed stars is followed by the first of the planets, Saturn, which completes the circuits in 30 years. After Saturn, Jupiter accomplishes a revolution in 12 years. Mars revolves in 2 years. The annual revolutions take a series fourth place and contains the Earth, together with the lunar sphere, as an epicycle. The fifth place, Venus, returns to 9 months. Lastly, the sixth place, Mercury, revolves in a period of 80 days. So he had numerical year dates, fractions, so he didn't have anything exact, and he had the outer sphere, plane. But he also didn't have the Sun at the very centre. He didn't have a heliocentric thing. This established the relationship in the order of the planets and their periods, and it made a unified system. This may be the most important arrangement in favour of the heliocentric model as Copernicus described it. It was far superior to Ptolemy's model, which had planets revolving around the Earth, and so that the Sun, Mercury and Venus all had the same annual revolution. In Book 1, Copernicus also insisted that the movements of all bodies must be circular and uniform, and noted the reason they may appear to non-uniform as either that the circles have poles different from that of the Earth, or that the Earth is not at the centre of the circles on which they revolve, revolutions. So he is sort of very, very mixed up in terms of everything has to be perfectly circular from Aristotle. So he's not the Copernican system. They really should talk about the Kepler system and then the modern system. It is not a thing. Particularly notable for Copernicus was that Ptolemy's model, the Sun, the Moon, and the five planets seems ironically to have different motions from the other heavenly bodies, and it made more sense for the small Earth to move than the immense heavens. Right, so he had fixed heavens, that may be the point. The five planets seemed... But the fact that Copernicus turned the Earth into a planet did not cause him to reject the Aristotelian physics, for he maintained that land and water together press upon a single centre of gravity, that the Earth has no other centre of magnitude, that since the Earth is heavier, its gaps are filled with water. As Aristotle has asserted, the Earth was the centre to which the physical elements gravitate. From this, this was a problem for Copernicus' model, because if the Earth is no longer the centre, why should the elements gravitate towards it? So, this is the key. So, the Copernican model didn't actually quite get there. It just had an inconsistency. The second book on revolutions elaborated the concepts of the first book. The third book dealt with the precession of the equinoxes and the solar theory. The fourth book dealt with the moon's motion. The fifth book dealt with planetary longitude, and the fourth book with the latitude. Copernicus depended very much on Ptolemy's observations, and there was little new in his mathematics. He was most successful in his work on planetary longitude, which, as Sidwell and Niekenberger commented, was, quote, Copernicus' most admirable and most demanding accomplishment. It was, above all, the decision to derive new elements for the planets that delayed for nearly half a lifetime Copernicus' continuation of his work. He derived new elements for the planets. Above all, the decision to derive... For nearly 20 years devoted to observation, and then several more to tedious kind of computation, the result was recognised by his contemporary as equal to Ptolemy's accomplishment, which was surely highly praised for an astronomer. Surprisingly, given that the elimination of the equant was so important to Cometerus, Cometerus did not mention in the book one, he sought to replace it with an epicyclet throughout the revolutions. Nevertheless, he did write in Book 5 when he was describing the motion of Mercury. So so there's an epicycle and an epicyclete. So it is really some sort of mash of Aristotelian spheres, and the sun is not the centre. Well, there you go. This is written by Copernicus. The ancients allowed the epicycle to move uniformly only around the equidistant centre. This procedure was in gross conflict with the true centre of the epicycle's motion, its relative distances and prior centres of both circles. However, in order that this last planet too may be rescued from the affronts and predecessors of its detractors, and from its uniform motion, no less than the other aforementioned planets may be revealed in relation to the Earth's motion, I shall allude to it as the circle mounted on its eccentric, and the eccentric instead of the epicycle accepted by antiquities. What the heck does that mean? I think it's sort of like trying to really understand Aristotle. At a certain point, it is really as bad as New Age garbage. Okay, Reticulus and the Nerito Primate. So Nerito Primate was Reticulus was the person who visited, and I think he wrote a summary of it, sort of a praises of it. Although Copernicus received encouragement to publish his book from his close friend, the Bishop Climo Tideman Gaius, and from the Cardinal of Capua Nicholas de Cusa is the person I really wanted to know. It was the arrival of Georg John Reticulus in Fromberg that solved his needs for a supportive and stimulated colleague in mathematics and astronomy, and for accessing to an appropriate printer. So this is he's in the sticks. He's got a book which no one can print. So that's the delay. It's not the fact that he was frightened of the church. In fact, the church actually said, it's against the Bible. It's actually quite interesting. That's his. But he was in a foggy place away from a printer. Reticulus was a professor of mathematics at the University of Wittenberg. I love the idea. We're going off to Wittenberg. Ho, ho, ho. You can imagine with that little Lady Heilson and the beer stein, the hat with a little brush in it. A major centre for mathematics. It is not known how Reticulus learned about Copernicus' theory. He may have been convinced to visit Copernicus by one of the early scholars he had visited. Johann Schuner, though, as Schwedlau and Leoberger noted, by, quote, the early 1530s, knowledge of Copernicus' new theory was circulating in Europe, even reaching the high and learned circles of the Vatican. Well, there you go. Reticulus brought with him some mathematical and astronomical volumes, which both provided Copernicus with some important material and showed him the quality of mathematical printing available by the German centres of publishing. You can imagine, not only did he want to publish, he wanted to publish maths. It's sort of like printing in colour. Reticulus, sort of like at the time of, do you put things for the cassette? Now, you know how you have the comics with the big dots, the dot printing? Reticulus present on the 1533 edition of Verculamus on all kinds of triangles. Reticulus present of the 1533 edition of Regiomontanus, all kinds of triangles. What a great thing! For example, convinced Copernicus to revise his section on trigonometry. But Reticulus was particularly interested in showing Copernicus the work from Nuremberg publisher John Petrus as a possible publisher of Copernicus' volume. Schedler and Nebu plausibly suggest that, quote, Petrus was offering to publish Copernicus' work, if not advertising by this note that he was already committed to do so. Reticulus wrote to Nerito Prima in 1540 as an introduction to the theories of Copernicus, which he published and circulated. This further encouraged Copernicus to publish the revolutions, which he had been working on since he published the Comitarius. So world could be breaking news, Sky News or Rupert Murdoch, wanting to get something newsworthy, scientific. You've got something scientific can only be done by scientific printing. You can imagine the idea of doing this would support. It's sort of like a publishing house wanting to have a newsworthy story. The Nerita Prima was written in 1539 and took the form of a letter to Johann Schurer announcing Copernicus' findings and describing the contents of the revolutions. Now, the interesting thing is that letters written to people could then be published. Sort of like there's different... This is a damn good letter, and it would have the authenticity that. He dealt with such topics as the motions of fixed stars, the tropical year, the ability of the elliptic, and the problems resulting from the motions of the sun, the motions of the earth and other planets. Libations, which is libations, is the apparent wobble. Like the moon libates as it comes down. Something in elliptic orbit, the actual axis, libates. Longitude of the five planets, the apparent deviation of the planets from the ecliptic. He asserted the heliocentric universe should have been adopted because it is better accounted for such phenomena as the precession of the equinoxes and the change in the ubiquity of the elliptic. It resulted in the diminution of the eccentricity of the sun. The sun was the centre of the difference of the planets. It allowed the circles in the universe to remove and revolve uniformly and regularly. It satisfied appearances more readily with fewer explanations necessary. United all the spheres into one system. Reticulus added astrological predictions and a number of mysticism, which is absent in Copernicus's work. Isn't that interesting? So he's got number mysticism, and it's also that number mysticism is that it should be a year, 9 months, 2 years, 12 years, 30 years. You know, it's got to be a set number of years, obviously. The Nerita, and it's interesting that he introduced number mysticism. Wow, that would be so whack. And so it's at a certain point of time, you've got to start to not go too deeply into it because you keep on asking it. It was whack. So it's very much interesting that he was not scared of publishing. He was unable to find a publisher. The Nerita Prima was printed in 1540 in Gdansk, now Danzig. Thus, it was the first printed description of Copernicus' thesis. Reticulus sent a copy to Achilles Primigesa of Friedrich, his hometown in modern-day Austria, and Gauhauser wrote a foreword that was published in the second edition that was produced in 1541. In Basel, the published again in 1596 as an appendix to the first edition of Johannes Kepler's Mysterium Cosmologum, A Secret of the Universe. This is the first completely Copernican work by an adherent since the publication of Copernicus and Reticulus. Well, there you go. Isn't that beautiful? Mystery. Printing, so this, the are mysteries because they didn't have gravity. They had, that only the Earth had gravity. Did Copernicus believe there were other elements on other planets? Printing on the revolutions and Ossander's preface. Ossander is such a wanker, isn't he? That's 2.5. The publication of Reticulus' Nerita Prima did not create a big stir against the heliocentric thesis, and so Copernicus decided to publish on revolutions. So there it was. There was no big thing. He added in a dedication to Pope Paul III, notably for political reasons, in which he expressed his heresy about publishing the work and the reasons he finally decided to publish it. He gave credit to Schoenberg and Gies for encouragement for him to publish and omitted the mention of Reticulus. But it would have been insulting to the Pope during the tense period of the Reformation to give credit to a Protestant minister. He dismissed critics who might have claimed that it was against the Bible by giving an example of the 4th century Christian apologist Lacatus, who rejected the sphere shape of the earth by asserting astronomy is written before astronomers. In other words, theologians should not meddle with it. Isn't that beautiful? Astronomy is written for astronomy. Theologians don't meddle with it. He pointed to the difficulty of the calendar reform because of motions of the heavenly bodies were inadequately known. He added attention to the fact that, quote, if the motions of other planets are correlated with the orbiting of the Earth, they are computed for revolutions for each planet. Not only their phenomena follow therefrom, but order and size of all planets and spheres and the heavens itself, so linked together that in no portion of it can anything be shifted without disrupting the remaining part of the universe as a whole. Isn't that is sort of profound gibbledygook, isn't it? Rheticus returned to Wittenberg, and so Rheticus is a Protestant. This is interesting. And Protestants were having great times publishing, and publishing was a technology which we didn't know. Returned to Wittenberg in 1541, and the following year received another leave of absence, at which time he took the manuscript of the Revolutions to Petrus for publishing in Nuremberg. Rheticus oversaw the printing of most of the texts. However, Rheticus was forced to leave Nuremberg later that year because he was appointed professor of mathematics at the University of Leipzig. He left the rest of the management of the printing of the Revolution to Andrew Osander, who died in 1498 and died in 1552. A Lutheran minister who was also interested in mathematics and astronomy. And the interesting thing is the people who hated Copernicus were the Protestants. Though he saw the project through, Osander apprehended and anonymously preface to the work. The true causes, he will adopt whatever suppositions enable the motions to be computed correctly from the principles of geometry for the future as well as for the past. These hypotheses need not be true or even probable. This clearly contradicted the body of the work. Both Rheticus and Gies protested, and Rheticus crossed it out on his copy. So he said, which it's something concerned him, he said, it's sort of academic beyond academic. So Copernicus said, astronomy is for the astronomy, and now this Osander actually said, theoretical thinking for theoretical thinking. 16th century reactions on the revolutions. Copernicus's fame and book made its way across Europe over the next 50 years. The second edition was brought out in 1566. As Greenwich's census of the existing copy showed, the book was already was read and commented on by astronomers. A full discussion of the reactions, see Greenwich noted the noted quote, the majority of 16th century astronomers thought the eliminating of the equant was Copernicus's biggest achievement. So it's the equitant, which is the distance that you revolve above the Earth. While Martin Luther may have made negative comments about Copernicus because the idea of the heliocentric universe seemed to contradict the Bible, so it's Luther who is against him. Philip Melanchthon, 1467 to 1560, who presided over the curriculum of the University of Wittenberg, eventually accepted the importance of the teaching Copernicus' ideas, perhaps because Alexander's preface made the work more palatable. Isn't that genius? Genius. It's just scientific gibbledygook. Surely it has no effect on the world. Isn't that beautiful? His son-in-law, Caspar Purser, taught astronomy there and began teaching Copernicus' work. As a result, the University of Wittenberg became the centre where Copernicus' work was studied. But Rheticus was the only Wittenberg scholar who accepted the heliocentric idea. Oh. Robert Wiseman suggested that the Wittenberg interpretation astronomers appreciated and adopted some of Copernicus' models, but rejected his cosmology. And some were pleased with the replacement of the equitant with epicyclates. So, what is an epicyclate? So, equitant is a distance. And now he has a little distance. Oh, God. One of these was Erasmus Reinhold, a leading astronomer of Wittenberg who became a dean and rector. He produced a new set of planetary tables from Copernicus' work called the Putinic Tables. Although Grinius pointed out that, quote, there was relatively little to distinguish between the accuracy of Alphonse's table and the Putinic table, the latter was more widely adopted. Grinius plausibly suggested the fact that the Putinic table were more accurately predicted the conjunction between Jupiter and Saturn in 1563, that is when the two planets appear in the same position of the sky, made the difference. Reinhold did not accept the heliocentric theory, but he admitted the elimination of the equant, the Putinic table, existed in the interest of Copernicus' work. So Copernicus had two separate epicyclists. So this is, they revolved around the Earth, but in a circle. Amazing. Tycho Brahe, 1546-1601, was the greatest astronomical observer before the invention of the telescope. He called Copernicus' second Ptolemy, and appreciated both the elimination of the equant and the creation of a planetary system. But Tycho could not adopt the Copernican system, partly for religious reasons that it went against the Bible seemed to preach. He therefore adopted a compromise geoheliostatic system, which the two inner planets revolved around the Sun, and the system along the rest of the planets revolved around the Earth. Among Catholics, Bishop Christoph Clavius was the leading astronomer of the 16th century. The Jesuit himself incorporated astronomy into the Jesuit curriculum and was the principal scholar behind the creation of the Gregorian calendar. Like Wittenberg astronomers, Clavius adopted Copernican mathematical models when he felt them superior, but believed Ptolemy's cosmology, both in the ordering of the planets and his use of equant, was correct. So there's equant and epicyclists. So there's epicycles and epicyclets. I don't know what that means is. Clopin VII had reacted favourably to talk about Copernicus' theory, rewarding the speaker with a rare manuscript. There was no indication how Pope Paul III, to whom the revolutions was declared dedicated, reacted. However, a trusted advisor, Bartholomew Spina de Pisa, intended to condemn it, but fell ill and died before his plan was carried out. Well, there you go. Go, God. So he was going to condemn it. Thus, in 1600, there was no official Catholic position on the Copernican system, and it was certainly not heresy. When Gordiano Bruno was burned at the stake as a heretic, it had nothing to do with the writings of Copernican cosmology. It was clearly shown in Freno's reconstructions of the accusations against Bruno. This is the entire thing. This is textbook. You know, I'm so angry at what we teach our kids. I must admit, I am so incredibly angry that when I say it's wrong, they get angry at me. They should be angry at what they've been taught. Answers the most interesting questions about Copernicus' ideas. The work have resulted in conjecture and inference. We can only guess why Copernicus adopted the heliocentric system. Most scholars believe the reason Copernicus rejected the Platonic cosmology was because of Ptolemy's equant. They assume this was because Copernicus wrote in Copernicus in Commentarius, quote, yet the widespread planetary theory is advanced by Ptolemy and most other astronomers, although consistent with the numerical data, seemed likewise to present no small difficulty. For these theories were not adequate unless they also conceived certain equalizing circles, which made the planets appear to move at all times with uniform velocity, neither on its different sphere or about its own epicycle center. Therefore, having become aware of these defects, I considered there could perhaps be found a more reasonable arrangement of circles from which the apparent irregularity would be derived, while everything itself would move uniformly, as required by the rule of perfect motion. So, really, I don't know where the epicyclus is a combination of the epicycle and quadrant, where the epicycle is actually brought back to the quadrant. But there, so we understand that the church was thinking about doing it, but the person who was going to condemn it died. Then everyone was fairly relaxed about it. The Lutherans had a way of getting it forward, but they disagreed with the Bible. Gordieu has plausibly maintained that while the initial motivation of Copernicus was dissatisfaction with the equidens, that dissatisfaction may have impelled him to observe other violations of uniform circular motion. Those observations, not the rejection of the equidens itself, led to the heliocentric theory. So it's a sort of two-step process. Bloomberg has pointed out that the mobility of the Earth may have been reinforced by the similarity of it spherical shape to those of the heavenly bodies. As a rejection of the equant suggests a return to Aristotelian demand for true uniform circular motion of the heavenly bodies, it is unlikely Copernicus adopted the heliocentric model because the philosophers popular among the Renaissance humanists like Neoplatonism and Hermetism compelled him in that direction. So he was actually trying to throw back to the spheres and circles. Nor should we attribute Copernicus's desire for uniform circular motion to aesthetic need, for this idea was philosophical, not aesthetic, and Copernicus replacing the equant with epicyclates made his system more complex than Ptolemy's. Most importantly, he should bear in mind what Schroeder and Neuburg asserted. So where is the sun going around epicyclates? Copernicus arrived at the heliocentric theory by careful analysis of planetary models. As far as known, he was the only person of his age to do so, and if he chose to adopt it, he did it on the basis of equally carefully analysis. So he was the first pioneer, so he wasn't a consensus thought. In the Commentarius, Copernicus listed assumptions that he believed solved the problems of ancient astronomy. He stated the Earth is the only center of gravity and the center of the moon's orbit, and that all spheres circle the sun, which is close to the center of the universe. It's not the center of the universe, and the universe is much larger than previously assumed. The Earth's distance from the sun is small, fraction of the size of the universe. The apparent motion of the heavens and the sun created the motion of the Earth, and the apparent motion of the planets is created by the Earth's motion. Although Copernican model maintained epicycles moving along the difference, it explained retrograde motion in the Ptolemaic model. Copernicus correctly explained the retrograde motion of planets was only apparent, not real. The appearance was due, in fact, to the observers and not to the rest of the centre. The work dealt very briefly with the order of the planets: Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, the only planets that could be observed with the naked eye, the triple motion of the Earth, daily rotation, and annual revolution at the centre, the annual revolution and its inclination that caused the Sun to seem to be in motion, the motion of the equinox and the revolutions of the Moon around the Earth, and the revolution of the five planets around the Sun. Okay, I'm going to finish that point, and we've got a small section to go. We're on page 3, 4, and 5 to go. Thanks a lot for listening. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.